This morning for our message, if you read the e-news, Lindsay and I are going to talk together. Here's what's up. We've been traveling through the book of Joshua, and last week was Jericho. And we got to Jericho, and if you turn to Joshua 6, you came to one of these verses that says, they utterly destroyed everything in the city, verse 21, both man and woman, young and old, and ox and sheep and donkey with the edge of the sword. And furthermore, they were doing that at God's command. What is this? So, Lindsay and I would like to talk about this command of God's, completely destroy them, utterly destroy them. God's command to Israel about the Canaanites. What kind of God is this? So many people have called him all kinds of things for this. We would call that, if that were going on today, genocide, ethnic cleansing, infanticide. Why is God doing that? I thought he was a God of love. And he loves his people, and he says so, but he just doesn't love these people. Is that what it is? So that's what we want to, we think it's important enough that we pause the series in Joshua to talk about this critical issue. And so that's what we're going to devote this time this morning. Neither of us feels adequate to do this. Books have been written on it, and more we study, the more I realize I don't know.
Yeah.
So why don't we first start by asking the Lord to help us in this discussion, and then this will be an opportunity for you to interrupt, raise a question, give an insight as well as time permits. But let's begin with prayer. Father in heaven, Lindsay and I are, it really seems audacious that we would purport to speak on your behalf about why you did this and why you didn't do that. And it would be utter foolishness if we didn't have your word in front of us and truths from that that you've communicated to us, we need help conveying, understanding, receiving. Would you help us this morning, both in the talking and the listening, because we've come to you first, asking you, and because we have committed, first and foremost, to hear it from you, your word. So would you open our hearts and eyes this morning? We pray this in the name of Jesus. Amen.
Well, we don't know how... I was thinking, I don't know how you react to these incidents in the Old Testament, and there are many of them. When you read incidents in the Old Testament of God telling his people to kill others, to wipe them out, how do you respond to that? Does that give you any pause? Do you, or do you spiritualize them? Or do they shake your faith in the Bible, especially in the Old Testament? I know that sometimes my faith has come to the edge with some of these things, but we want to explore some of the issues this morning. I think in order to set the tone, we need to go back from Joshua. Let's go back to Deuteronomy. And in the text in Deuteronomy, beginning in chapter 7, at the first verse, let me go through and just highlight some of the things that are said. When the Lord your God brings you into the land, this is now Moses instructing the people according to the word of God that he had received. When the Lord your God brings you into the land you are entering to possess and drives out before you many nations, the Hittites, Girgashites, Amorites, Canaanites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites, seven nations larger and stronger than you. You have a sense of how big the nation of Israel was. And when the Lord your God has delivered them over to you and you have defeated them, then he tells them to do three things. Here's the first. Then you must destroy them totally. Make no treaty with them and show them no mercy. The second thing is, do not intermarry with them. Do not give your daughters to their sons or take their daughters to your sons, for they will turn your children away from following me to serve other gods. And the Lord's anger will burn against you and will quickly destroy you. Now, let me pause if I may. What's this about kill them off and then don't intermarry? Well, if we go down to verse 22 of that same chapter, we read that this is going to take a long time. It's to take a long time for them to kill off the people, and therefore there's the threat of intermarriage in the meantime. And then the third point, this is what you are to do with them, do to them, break down their altars and smash their sacred stones, cut down their Asherah poles, and burn their idols in the fire. And here's the reason. For you are a people holy to the Lord your God. The Lord your God has chosen you out of all the peoples on the face of the earth to be his people, his treasured possession. Wow. That's what God tells them to do? Kill off all the people. Don't intermarry with them in the meantime. And break down all their religious accoutrements. That's how God instructs them, because he says, you are a people holy to me. Now, what we would like to do is we'd like to go through a number of questions that obviously arise from this. And we're going to start with the two biggies. And I'm going to pose them to Paul, and he's going to answer them. And then we'll see where it goes from there. The first question is this. Why do the Israelites have the right to take the land which has been occupied by people for a number of years? Does the land not belong to these people by right of occupation? Now, God had promised Israel the land, but in the meantime, these people had occupied it. Why do they have the right to take it? The second question is, why do they have the right to march into the land and just kill the people? Men, women, children, in order to occupy that land. Is that not genocide? The texts indicate that this slaughter was on a massive scale. What we read in Deuteronomy chapter 7, these are a people larger than you. Now, a lot of people reckon that the people of Israel at that time numbered about 2 million. So we're talking a lot of people. He's talking about killing peoples larger than them. So, Paul, where would you like to begin? Let's just see if we can wrestle with these and start us off, please.
Well, okay. The short answer is that the Israelites don't have the right to go in there and take the land and kill all the people. But God does have that right. And he has the right because he owns the land. In fact, we need a little bit of a history here. You remember, let's go backwards. Here we are, Joshua at Canaan. Before that was Moses. Before that was 400 years in Egypt. Before that was Abraham. God tells Abraham, I'm going to give you this land. But the Canaanite iniquity is not yet to the complete fullness of itself yet. So there's going to be 400 years, okay? But before Abraham was what? Well, before Abraham, let's go to this chart. This shows the flood on the left line there, and the flood happened, and Noah lived quite a long time after the flood. But when Noah and his sons got off the boat, what did God say? He made a covenant with that people, and he said, I'm going to give you the land, I want you to multiply in it, and I want you to do this and this, and you're to serve me, and here's the rainbow as my sign, and I make a covenant with you, and so forth. And Noah's sons were Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and Ham's son was Canaan, for whom the Canaanites were named. 10 generations after that covenant between God and all of humanity, through Noah and his sons, we come to Abram and Terah, and they don't even know who the God Yahweh is. How did that happen? How did in 10 generations space of time, and if my PowerPoint were better, you could see that Noah is a contemporary of Abram, and Shem, Noah's son, who was also on the boat, lived past Abram. In other words, all of the generations that were alive at Abram and Canaanite iniquity was running full strong, but not strong enough, all of those people could have gone to Noah and Shem and found out the real deal if they'd wanted to. They could have found those people and known the truth that God conveyed to all these people. Does that have any bearing on you? That quickly, Ham's son Canaan ran headlong into developing their own gods, Baal, Anath, all of these other gods. And those gods weren't a bunch of people wandering around wondering, who do we serve? No, those were people who knew the truth, who departed headlong, ran away from the truth, and created gods, little g gods, of their own mythology and tradition. And they weren't just, you know, I think we ought to worship the weather or something, the sun and the moon. No, these were horrible gods, orgiastic and vile and debauched and loved butchering people. One of the Canaanite gods used to swim around neck high in the blood and wash the hands in the human gore. And the worship of these gods was temple prostitution and child sacrifice and all kinds of just horrendous stuff. Murder, there was bestiality and homosexuality in the normal life, but also in the temple worship. Anyway, all of these kinds of things happened in just a short space of time. Abram was born... I'm sorry, that thing isn't more clear. 292 years after the flood, and the knowledge of God is virtually non-existent in those 300 years. They have run away from God. 300 years. Our nation's been around 2 1/4. They have run from God, all of humanity, but Canaan, the land of Canaan, was especially diligent in that. So back to this. God owns the land, and he apportions it to those who serve him. And he gave it first to Adam and his generation, and they blew it. They did not serve for the most part, with just a few remnant. And so God said, that's not going to work with me. I will give the earth to those who will serve me. And he started over with Noah. And before long, we see what I just showed you. They were not serving the Lord at all. In fact, they were going as fast as they could in the other direction. He apportions it to those who serve him. And the Canaanites were heinous idolatries. And God said, you don't have the right, Israel, to go up there and do it, but I have the right to judge them. And I can do it with a flood. I can do it with this means of this. And at this time, he said, I'll do it with Israel. Now, respond to that. I don't know if that is at all an answer to...
No, that's good. That's helpful. I think one of the things that I feel is helpful as well is that God reveals himself in the Old Testament under a number of names, and one of the names that he reveals himself under is the Lord of Hosts, or the Lord of Armies, which is what everyone takes hosts to mean. The Lord of Armies. And he is called that well over 100 times in the Old Testament. The people of Canaan were not neutral. They're the enemy of God. They are part of the enemies of God. They are part of the forces who are attacking God. they are part of the forces of the enemy in conflict with God. And so it's not as if God is destroying neutral or innocent people. He is fighting his enemies. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a big factor. It's a big factor that helps me be more comfortable with what God does in this case with the Canaanites.
And where does this idea of little gods and the worship of sticks and stones and all the things and the orgy, all that stuff, where is that rooted? We have to remember that's rooted in Satan, the chief of demons. And so all of these gods are his work, little gods are his work. So it's not just some, oh, aren't those uncivilized people kind of uneducated and they don't know any better? No, this is the work of Satan. And it's direct defiance against God. And back to the land. God owns the land. He says, now I'm going to give it to Israel. But he promises them, if they walk away from him, he will remove them from the land. So the issue is, God owns the land. He apportions it to those who serve him. The Canaanites were definitely not serving him, their idolatry, and so forth.
There's a text in Leviticus chapter 18, beginning at verse 24, and allow me to read it to you. Do not defile yourselves in any of these ways. This is God speaking to the people. Because this is how the nations that I am going to drive out before you became defiled. Even the land was defiled. So I punished it for its sin, and the land, listen to this, the land vomited out its inhabitants. For all these things were done by the people who lived in the land before you, and the land became defiled. And if you defile the land, God speaking to Israel, if you defile the land will vomit you out as it vomited out the nations who were before you. Mm-hmm. Wow. They were so evil that the very nature, the land would vomit them out. These people were guilty of something very, very serious.
And when we see it that way, we see that it's not that God was against a certain race. He was against sin and the people who committed sin, whether those were pre-flood people or whether they're the land of Sodom and Gomorrah, the same thing. God said, enough of this. And by the way, Sodom and Gomorrah were descendants of Canaan. There's something to that curse on Canaan. But they also, and they reached the fullness of their iniquity sooner than the rest of the Amorites. And now God says to Israel as well, if you perform like this, I just hate sin, I'll wipe you out as well from the land. Well, shall we move on?
Yes.
And feel free to stop us if you need to. Okay, next question. Are you reading that one or am I?
You read that one, I'll try and start answering it.
All right. What about all the innocent women and children? We have a little bit of an understanding of how God could we can understand or swallow a little bit better God coming in and wiping out all these fighting evil men in the war. But what about the women? And then especially, what about innocent children? Why did God order their annihilation?
This is a tough one. I think it's a very troubling question. It's a very mind-bending question, I think. But I think we should attempt to answer it. Think about some of the things that God has done otherwise. For example, he has taken the lives of many individuals in judgment. Here's a familiar one, right? Ananias and Sapphira in Acts chapter 5. Where they had lied about what they had given to God and God cut them off. He wiped out the firstborn of Egypt. He utterly destroyed the city of Sodom. And I mean, there are a lot of incidents like this, especially in the Old Testament. In the flood of Noah, he took the lives of virtually the whole population of the earth. Now, here's my question. Are you outraged by any of these incidents? Have you ever been outraged by any of those incidents? Do they seem to be you reasonable under the circumstances? And if they do, then I say, so does this. If we trust, and I think this is, here's the issue. If we trust the judgment of God to be able to execute these other people in these other situations, we must also trust his judgment in this case. That we can trust that God indeed is doing to the Canaanites what is just and what is right because he knows their hearts. Now, I think it's a little more complicated than that, but I think that's where we need to begin. Mm-hmm.
In fact, just fleshing that out just a little bit, they, like the people that you mentioned, Sodom and Gomorrah, pre-flood people, the Canaanites were inventors and perfecters of evil.
Yeah.
And God finally just says, that is enough, and we're not going to put up with that. Genesis 6:5, every intent of the thoughts of their hearts was only evil continually. That's what God said about man before the flood. And that's what he's basically saying. He said it about Sodom. He brought that to it. He couldn't even find 10 righteous. And then we have that verse in Genesis 8, shall not the judge of all the earth do right? So that's the concept that you're alluding to. Will we trust the Lord to do right? Or are we going to have a real problem, as many do, with the whole idea of God even being fair and right? Henry's got a question. Good. All right.
Mm-hmm. Now, I think what we have said so far still leaves the children sort of hanging. What about the children? If we believe, I don't know what your belief is, but if we believe that that our children, before they reach the age of accountability, are in the hands of God as far as judgment is concerned, and he, in fact, based on what his son has done at Calvary, he applies the salvation of Calvary to them, and their eternal destiny is heaven, not hell. If we believe that for our children, then can we not also believe that for other children? Mm-hmm. That seeing God as the just and loving God, and these children have not yet personally sinned against him yet, that we can trust God as to their destiny. Mm-hmm. In fact, I don't know that we... I think there's a thought that even though all of the peoples of these cities and nations, even though many of them were killed, if there were a few among them who really turned their hearts toward God before they were killed, God could... They were killed, but he could have taken them into eternal life. I mean, that's a possibility, right? But that's my thought as far as the children are concerned. Is that valid?
A lot of people postulate that as well. Another is just that God, I'll skip to this third one here, God prevented further escalation of evil, not only with Israel, like Henry was saying, to keep the influence down, but God prevented further escalation of Israel of evil in that next generation that would grow up and learn the ways of their evil, wicked parents. Yeah. And what happens if that child grows up and learns the evil, wicked ways of his parents? Well, then he is condemned for that as well, and he is more accountable and more to blame. So God says, enough of that. We're gonna prevent further escalation of Israel. Let me ask you folks for a minute. Could you ever see yourselves picking up a rifle and putting somebody in the crosshairs of that, their head, and pulling the trigger? That'd be an atrocious act of injustice on your part to just pull the trigger on somebody else, wouldn't it? But wait a minute. What if it was a month ago on April 15th in the city of Boston, and you know what you know now, that there come those two brothers, they've got backpacks on their back, and they are about to obliterate three lives and destroy 260 people's health. Could you pull the trigger then? And what about, remember back a few years back, Columbine in Colorado, and those boys had all of the arsenal with them, and they were just mowing people down one after the other. And finally, the SWAT team got in there, and he did that exactly. He put that head in his scope, and he pulled the trigger. Why? To prevent further escalation. He could have said, no, I can't take a life. Well, then what were those two boys going to keep doing? Keep taking lives. So that's one example to help me see that God prevented further escalation of Israel by this race that had just run headlong into evil, by bringing that to an end, and by not allowing the children to grow up and perpetuate that as well.
Good.
And what Henry said is the middle one there, to protect Israel from defilement and idolatry. He knows how much we are influenced by the impact of those around us. And
yeah, I mean, we recently in the class in the earlier hour talked about Solomon, and his problem was that he took all these foreign wives, and all these foreign wives brought their idols with them, and Solomon ended up worshiping the idols. Solomon, who should have known better, look at his heritage, and it ruined him.
Mm. Mm. Lindsay and I have been looking at a number of sources, and we thought we'd share them with you. One is R.C. Sproul, The Holiness of God. Paul Copan, Is God a Moral Monster? Interestingly, Paul Copan fellowshipped here at Woodland Hills when he was in school. Then under that is one, Show Them No Mercy. Can't read the... It's God and the Canaanite Genesis by Gundry. And there is an apologist, Christian apologist, William Lane Craig. And then another one, Peter C. Craigie, The Problem of War in the Old Testament. So these are some of the sources we went to. But one thing that R.C. Sproul said was this. I thought it was a statement I wanted to share with you. Quote, whenever God tolerated or commanded violent action in the Old Testament, it was to restrain evil or to deter some greater atrocity. Mm. So whether it's the flood, or whether he's raining down on Sodom and Gomorrah, or whether he is sending Israel in as his instrument of judgment against Canaan, whenever God tolerated or commanded violent action in the Old Testament, it was to restrain evil or deter some greater atrocity. I didn't say that. R.C. Sproul did. And I haven't had time to think through every aspect of that, but on the surface, it sounds like that might be something of value.
Mm-hmm.
All right, where are we? You want to keep moving?
Yeah.
Okay. Let's go to another question that comes to the surface. Why did God have Israel? Why didn't he just do another flood? Why did God have Israel kill these people rather than do it himself, as he did in other cases? Furthermore, wouldn't this, some Israelite ran a sword through a woman or cut a child's head off. That Israelite has to, we know what post-traumatic stress does to our soldiers. What would that do to Israeli men who had to do that? This one's Lindsay's.
Well, I think, first of all, we need to see these issues in their historical context. That was a different age. The Late Bronze Age was an age very different from the 21st century. And these people, there was a certain... Has our social conscience developed since then? I tend to think it has, to some degree at least. I don't know what the consciences of these people were like, but it seems to me that today, the kind of things that they did, they would have been brought up before The Hague on war crimes charges. But in those days, those actions seemed to be perfectly normal, frankly. I don't see anybody protesting. I don't read about protest among the Israelite soldiers. There are a lot of things in the Old Testament in that age which were appropriate to that age which are no longer appropriate. There were laws governing slavery and polygamy. There was a monarchy as opposed to a system of monarchy rather than democracy. There was a system of patriarchy where the father pretty well said what went and it went. It's a different age with different attitudes. And I think that needs to be recognized. And the MO of that day was the kind of violence that we see pictured in the book of Joshua. When David, for example, a little bit later, was fleeing from Saul, he supported himself by raiding other people. And plundering them. So it's a different age. I think another factor to consider is that what I mentioned earlier, that God revealed himself as the Lord of hosts, and he's portrayed throughout that period as in opposition to his enemies. Now, that largely drops in the Old Testament, in the New Testament, until we come to the book of Revelation. And then it's picked up again. And then we have the conflict, and the conflict brought to its consummation.
And that would have its roots in the whole concept of the war against not just humans, but the ultimate war of good and evil, a God against the one who has thrown the tyranny of Satan, who has usurped the earth, and this all flows out in warfare.
Exactly. And I think largely that when the term Lord of Hosts refers to the armies of the angels, but then God calls upon the soldiers of Israel to participate in that war and to do what they were called to do.
Another thought on this, why did God use Israel to do this cleansing? God was raising his people up to be what? A holy people. And there was something in their participating with him in the cleansing of the land that I think people recognize as a clear object lesson to holiness for that nation.
Yeah, yeah. And God brought two things together. He brought together his promise to give the people the land and his threat to punish the Canaanites. And by the people of Israel, he accomplished both those purposes. Mm-hmm. And in his wisdom, he chose to do it in that way.
Mm-hmm. Shall we go on then?
Yes.
Is it possible that the people who inhabited the land were so wicked as to deserve instant death? Were they all that bad?
Well, I think we've answered that in some measure already. And I think what Paul has said about the religion of the Canaanites, and he's only skimmed the surface. I mean, when you read about the religion of the Canaanites, it is shocking. Mm-hmm. They had every kind of perversion that you could think of. It's really quite astonishing. And the whole culture seemed to be poisoned. Mm-hmm. And as far as the innocent children were concerned, I tried to say something about that earlier. Mm-hmm. But I know we can have confidence in the judgment of God, right? Mm-hmm. So that his verdict on these people is just. Mm-hmm. We can trust him. I think that's the bottom line on that score.
All right. And you allowed for God to have given grace to some. And we saw that with who recently in the book of Joshua? Rahab.
Yeah.
Rahab said, if you look in Joshua 2, she said, hey, the news of you guys has come to us. And verse 'We have heard about how the Lord dried up the water. I know the Lord has given you the land, and the terror of you Israelites has fallen on us, and all the inhabitants of the land have melted away before you. When we heard what you guys did and what the Lord did, verse 11, our hearts melted, and no courage remained in any man any longer because of you. And then, what is this word? For the Lord, that's Yahweh, for Yahweh your God, he is God in heaven above and on earth beneath. Now, therefore, I want to come with you guys. And that's what Rahab did. And she didn't just bring herself, she brought her whole family along with her, and they were incorporated into the God-fearing people of Israel. And then just a couple chapters from now, and we haven't gotten there yet, is Gibeah. Gibeonites came up with a way to avoid this extermination as the other Canaanites did. It was trickery, but why? They said as much. We knew that God was doing this thing, and they became followers of God. So, no, the answer is not all of the people were destroyed. The ones God put his name out there, and all of the people, we see it again in chapter 5, when verse 1, all the kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan and all the kings of the Canaanites by the sea heard how the Lord had dried up the waters of the Jordan before the sons of Israel. Their hearts melted and there was no spirit in them any longer because of what God had done for the sons of Israel. But did they repent? No. So you see, God put his name out there. God put his fame out there. God and some came, but not most. Well, we better hasten on.
Yeah. How about the last question?
Okay, which is?
Which is,
did the people
of the land have a chance to turn to God to avoid this annihilation?
Which I guess is what I was sort of talking on there.
Yeah. And I mean, these instances that you've already mentioned, Paul, answer that here were people, the God of Israel became pretty famous. And these people of the land knew about him and about his actions, and how did they respond? They feared God, trembled, but they didn't go any farther to fear him in the sense of awesome respect and turning to him for salvation. It just didn't quite get there.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So what is the issue then? Can we recap it? And why did God command complete destruction for the Canaanites? Well, God owns the land, and he apportions it to those who serve him. They were absolutely heinous idolatry, and God wanted that eradicated. They were inventors and perfecters of evil. Practice makes perfect, they seem to say, and God has limits in his patience, and he will punish. Hebrews 11 tells us the Canaanites were disobedient. They knew, whether it was written in their hearts, whether it was natural revelation, whether it was the word they were given about what God did in Egypt and through the sons of Israel and crossing the Red Sea and the Jordan, they were disobedient. So to use the phrase innocent is a stretch. First of all, none of us is innocent in the basic sense of the word. But the people of Canaan were not even, they went beyond that. Why else did God command complete destruction? To prevent further escalation of Israel of evil, excuse me. And finally, what was God on a mission to do? He was bringing light to a dark world. He was bringing, what was that class we did for the last number of weeks? God is bringing his redemption story to the world, and he had a plan to fulfill a promise to Abraham. and bring a holy people and eventually a Messiah. And here's the Canaanites, and they're everything opposite, and Satan giving all the energy he can to everything opposite of God. And God said, I'm going to bring light to a dark place. I'm going to start by bringing, and what is it? We tend to think that life is a right. We tend to think we should expect 70 years or so. And when a person is cut off at age 10, we think, oh, they were shortchanged by God. No. God said to Adam, when you eat of it, you shall die. That was not just a spiritual death, that was a physical death. And God says elsewhere, the soul that sins, it will die. What then is that 10 years or 1 year or 50 years or 70 years that God gives us? It is the time for grace and mercy to have time to operate in our lives. And some people run hard after it, after everything but his grace. And God says, I'm bringing to an end for you the time of grace. And he did that for the Canaanites. He did it for the people of Sodom. He did it for the people before the flood. And he does it with individuals that we're aware of that press hard in sin. And God says, it's time. I'm bringing the grace, the time of grace, to an end in your life. Do you want to add anything?
No, that's good.
Okay. I think that in the final analysis, we need to see it this way. Most of us have, I think of it in terms of a continuum. And we think here's a continuum of what is fair and what is arbitrary. And we think that we are in the middle and we understand where it is. And there's a continuum of what is loving and just. And we think we have all of the center points. We have patient and what's quick to punish, and where's holy and compassionate and innocent and wicked and righteous, and when is he capricious? And we think we understand the but actually on all of these things we have an inadequate grasp of God's holiness and God's hatred for sin, and he's expressed it over and over from Genesis on down, and many individuals and many nations have run fast and loose with God's commands on holiness. And God says, that's enough. That's enough. Mm-hmm. And the Canaanites, but you know, he doesn't do that readily. Think about it from this sense. Think about God's enormous reluctance to see people pay the penalty of sin. The lengths to which he goes in order to not punish people with death. How long were the Israelites in Egypt while the iniquity of the Amorite was allowed to continue to grow? 400 years. That means he put his own people in slavery for an additional 400 years because he was unwilling to hurriedly bring the time of their grace to an end. God wrote the law, Romans says, on their hearts. God gave us enough in natural revelation so that he says, we are without excuse, we run hard away from him. God sent a prophet to Nineveh. Why? He cared about, what does it say, 100,000 people who did not know their right hand from their left hand. He did not want to destroy them like Jonah wanted him to. Probably those were children who don't know the difference between their right hand and their left hand. And many animals, he said. But finally, he sent his own son. He sent his own son so that people would not have to pay the ultimate price for their sin. Life comes to an end, yes, but this is nothing compared to what is in the next life. And God knows that. And so God sent his own son. In fact, his own son was the only one who could say, "You treated me unfairly. You gave me a punishment that I did not deserve." He didn't say that, but he is the only one ever that could have said that because he took our penalty on him. He did not deserve what he was given. We deserved it, but he took it. And so we have an inadequate grasp of God's holiness and an inadequate understanding of how offensive sin is to holy God. So much so that we can't really understand fully why God had to send his son to free us. We think there's a little bit more redemptive value in each of us. and in that person over there, and that person, and even in a Canaanite. And God says, you don't have your point at the right point. You need to understand what holiness is. And you understand what sin is to a holy God, and we don't fully grasp that. Mm-hmm. I don't, and I don't think we do. Mm-hmm. So we're going to go to the Lord's table now. And before we do that, we're going to sing. And we're going to try to realign ourselves with God's holiness to get a final summarizing point to why did God destroy the Canaanites? God is holy. But it doesn't stop there. God made provision for any who will turn to him, any who will turn to him through the blood of his son, Jesus Christ.